All right, welcome to Greek Club. We are back recording, and so our millions of listeners on the iTunes U site are welcome back. We've been away for a few months, but our many thanks to our technology people. We did take the summer off, so even though now it's October, we are in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, and we are going to pick up at verse 3. I mentioned last week, just to say briefly, that the tone that Paul uses really changes here in chapter 10. He becomes, conciliatory and grateful and quite a bit more confrontational as he turns to speak to those in the Corinthian congregations who may be inclined to oppose him, if I could say it that way. Verse 3, we'll just take that, and then verse 4, 5, and 6 all kind of go together. So verse 3 is relatively easy. And it might sound something like, En sarkigar peripatuntes, ou katasarka stratuamatha. And then, as you can see, verse 4 begins with a gar, but we'll stop there. One of the issues facing the Apostle Paul seems to have been that he didn't conform to the view of the Corinthians of what an impressive apostle would be like, right? So that's kind of the issue here, and he's answering that. Verse 3, 4, literally, walking in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. I mean, all of a sudden, martial language comes into play here, and we'll get a lot of strat roots, if I could say it that way. And the participle there, peripatuntes, this is a very typical Hellenistic Greek construction. The referent, the participle, of course, agrees with its referent in gender, number, and case. And there isn't a masculine plural nominative referent, except the one that's implied by the verb. So the we of we are waging war, or we are campaigning. And so, therefore, you take all of those, when the referent is the unexpressed subject of the verb like that, you translate those participles all as predicate position. So the full array of options, it could be temporal, causal, concessive, so forth. And I think this one is normally taken concessively. For even though we are walking in the flesh, just in our human existence, we are not waging war according to the flesh, which is kind of setting up something which Paul is now going to explain with another gar clause, quite a long one, actually. Stratuo mai is middle deponent, and it means to be a soldier or to campaign or something like that. And you can see, just we get stratuo mai, we get stratea, we get all kinds of military language, fortresses and things like that coming up. So, again, the tone changes really quite remarkably. But other than that, it's not too hard. One dependent participle and then a main verb, which is just an indicative mood verb. So, comments, questions, anything on verse 3? All right. Well, we'll take 4, 5, and 6 together, believe it or not. And let me just point out the verb is, the main verb is elided. We have to supply it. The weapons of our warfare are not. We have to supply the linking verb. And then we have, at the last word in verse 4, participle. Then, at the end of the next line, participle. And then verse 6, first full line, participle. So we actually have three participles hanging off a verb that isn't there, if I could say it that way. So, and again, it's a little broken, and we've seen that before here in 2 Corinthians. But it would sound something like this, at least in my particular mode of reading Greek. Targar hapla te strateas hemon, ou sarkika, Allah, dinata to Theo, pros kath irisen achiromaton. And now come the participles. Here's the first one. Lugismus kath iruntes kai pan hipsoma ep iramanon kata tes gnosa estu theou. Note the comma. Here comes the second participle. Kai aichmalo tidzantes pan naima estain hippakoen tu Christu. Here comes the third one. Kai en hetoimo ekantes ekte kesai pasan parakoen hatan plerothe humon he hippakoe. So, for the tools, a hoplos is a tool, but in a military context, a weapon. For the weapons of our campaign, a strateia is a campaign, a military campaign. And you have to supply are not fleshly, rather, repeat the implied verb, they are powerful. Now, the dative here, you know, you could translate it differently. It could be powerful because of God, powerful with respect to God, powerful in God, something like that. And they are powerful, pros something, toward. And, of course, pros plus the accusative readily expresses purpose. And so you could even translate for the purpose of. Now, kath irazin is a noun related to kathaireo, which means to tear down or destroy. For the tearing down of an achiramaton. This is the neuter plural genitive. It means fortresses. I had to look it up. Strongholds, literally. The adjective achiros is not one that I knew. It means strong. So strong places, strongholds, fortresses. Right. And now we have these participles, and in order to get a referent, we have to actually kind of jump back over the beginning of the gar clause and link it to stratuomatha. Right? So that would be the masculine plural nominative we, if I could say it that way. And, you know, again, these predicate position participles, I tried on a causal translation, because we are doing these things or while we are doing these things. You know, those are some of the options. I rather like the causal translation. Now we get the participle from kath aireo. We had the related noun in the lineup above, kath airesis. And so we'll take them causally. Because we are tearing down lugismuses. Arguments, reasonings, debates. And not only that, but we're tearing down. And every hipsoma. A hipsoma is an elevated thing. And I think this is variously translated. Maybe sometimes even arrogance or something like that. But you get the sense of it. And now hipsoma is modified adjectivally by epiramenon. This is just from epiro, which means to lift up. And it could be a middle participle, but I think it's taken here as passive. Every elevated thing or every arrogance which is being lifted up against, kata plus the accusative means according to, but with the genitive it means against the knowledge of God. And this could be the knowledge that comes from God, or it could be to know God. So it could actually be a genitive of source or a genitive of an objective genitive. And when you don't know what it is and are too afraid to make a choice, you say, it's both. Right? This is called the genitive of wimpiness, right? Which I think is actually a category in the second edition of Daniel Wallace's grammar. Right? This his fine grammar, but we kid him because he has so many uses of the genitive. That's right. Okay, so now we get the second participle. And we wage war because we are taking captive. Aich malo tidzo. This is the word that occurs in Colossians where Christ takes the authorities captive. We are, and because we are taking captive every thought unto or for the obedience of Christ. And that is probably an objective genitive. We're obeying Christ. And that's the goal towards which we take every thought captive. And now you get the third participle. Once again, masculine plural nominative, ekontes. This is a little bit of an idiom. It occurs elsewhere in the New Testament, but it may actually have been here in 2 Corinthians. I did not look it up. To literally having in readiness, which simply, not surprisingly, means being ready, right? And because we are ready, this is from ektikao, and it's the aorist infinitive active. It's a weak aorist, so it looks like lusai, if you remember your paradigm, weak aorist infinitive from luo. And ektikao means to, right, that was a rhetorical question. Again, I remember these things because I teach them. It means to punish. And we are ready, because we are ready, to punish every disobedience whenever, hatan now will take a subjunctive mood verb, whenever your obedience is fulfilled. And I actually don't know what that means. I was trying to imagine, what would that... So we're ready to punish every disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. Does that mean first he sees how far they're going to comply, and then he brings out the apostolic hammer? I mean, exactly, I'm not quite sure. But let's back all the way up then to verse 3, and I'll give kind of a running translation, and you guys can make comments, or if you have any questions, you can ask him. So verse 3. For although we are walking in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. Because the weapons of our campaign are not fleshly, rather, they are powerful because of God for the tearing down of fortresses. Because we are tearing down arguments and every arrogance which is being lifted up against the knowledge of God, and because we are taking captive every thought unto the obedience of Christ, and because we are ready to punish every disobedience whenever your obedience is fulfilled. Have a nice day, right? I mean, it's very stern, right? And it's gonna get worse, if I could say it that way, in chapter 11. So, questions? Just when you were glad that we were having short sentences, now we get long ones. Anything? Yeah, James? Yeah, what do you think?
The meaning of the last phrase?
Yeah.
It might be that, you can't judge unless you're above the judgment yourself, kind of thing. Like,
okay.
Once your obedience is set,
okay,
then you can try and correct others.
Okay. Yeah, although Paul is the one who's doing the judging. He's the one doing the punishing. I mean, Paul and his coworkers. So it's not... You will be ready to judge when your obedience is fulfilled, but the referent of the participle is the we. Yeah, I mean, isn't that interesting? I mean, that thought actually makes sense. I'm just not sure it fits with the grammar. So it's definitely an orthodox thought. Yeah, right. Which is kind of like judge not lest you be judged, and beam and mote and that kind of thing. You know, so yeah. Martin Fransman is credited with saying this, and I'm just picking on James here a little bit because I like him so much. The gospel cannot do the work of Hutty. And what he means by that is you actually let the grammar run the show rather than saying orthodox things. So, on the conviction, of course, that the grammar is orthodox, right? So, yeah. Mike, you had a comment.
Question on verse 6.
Golly, is that one of them phones? It's got Greek on the screen?
It does.
Dang. Okay, go right ahead.
The ektikao,
yes.
The dictionary form is, do you know how Paul uses that? Is that used in reference to another verse?
Oh, that's a good question. I kind of guessed what it meant, but I had to look it up to make sure. So I don't know how common ektikao. I think it's ektikao.
So like, I'm just trying to guess what would punishment look like. Is it casting out the brother who's...
Well, yeah.
Right,
like 1 Corinthians. Right. Handing over to Satan, that odd phrase that occurs in 1 Corinthians and 1 Timothy.
Is it okay to associate those kinds of things?
At least generally, yeah, I think so. Because, you know, in chapter 12 or 13, I think Paul is going to say, now test yourselves. Are you really in Christ? I mean, really, it gets very harsh. And we mentioned last week, I think it was last week, that that's one of the reasons. There are some who theorize that chapters 10 to 13 is actually a separate letter, which, and maybe even thinking that it's the so-called sorrowful letter that's mentioned at the beginning of 2 Corinthians, just because, you know, Paul has really been happy with them all the way, in a sense, from chapter 2 to chapter 9, and he's the relationship is being reconciled and all that kind of stuff, and now all of a sudden we get this military language. I don't think that theory is necessary, and I don't think it's all that popular anymore. But you can see, you know, why someone might have actually thought that. So, yeah. Yeah, so what precise forms the ekdikaoing would take, Mike? I think the things you mentioned are definitely possibilities. So, look at that. Is that like a, what is that thing, Dave? Is that a?
It's like a giant phone.
Oh, man.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that like, are those things battery? Is that what they're not solar, are they? Your battery? When your battery runs out, you're toast. But I will live forever because I have my...
If I send the iPad 5...
Okay. Yeah, okay, good. Good. iPad. Okay.
So you can't jabber on.
No, I can't. That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay. Let's go on into the next paragraph. Let's see. We can take verse 7. Ta kata prosopon blepita. Etis pepoithen ha auto Christu enai. Tuta la gezesto palen fhaotu, hati kathos autos Christu, hutos kai hemes, he said emphatically. Blepita, of course, is just our great friend blepo, and it could be an indicative, you are seeing, but here it's parsed and translated as an imperative, which it could also be. So see, literally, the things according to face. I think this means look what's in front of you or something like that. I think that's, you know, pay attention here, right? And now we have a conditional sentence. If someone, tis, now pepoithen is the perfect of patho. Patho means to persuade. And somehow, without going into it too much, the perfect of patho means to be confident. Okay? So this is a perfect indicative active third singular. If someone has been and is confident in respect to himself, to be of Christ, literally. But this, you could probably label this infinitive, that's enai from the linking verb eime, as, anybody want to guess, the infinitive that's expressing to be confident that, indirect discourse. It's an infinitive of indirect discourse. If someone is confident, so you could translate it with regard to himself, that he is of Christ, or belongs to Christ, probably, let him, legizesto, there's the... this is from legizimai, which means to reckon. And it's the third person imperative. So in English, we translate, let him reckon this again. Now, this is epi plus the genitive. epi can mean anything you want it to mean, just about. And so I'm going to translate it about himself or in relation to himself. And here's what you're supposed to reckon. That, just as he himself, supply, is of Christ, in this way also we, emphatic. So Paul is trying to take someone down a notch or two. That's what he's trying to do. So, yeah, good. Not too bad. Questions, comments, anything? All right. We'll keep going then. Verse 8 is punctuated as a sentence. Eante gar perisaterante kauchesomai perites exousias hemon heis edoken hakyrias eis oikodemein kai uk eis kathairesen humon uk aiskunthesomai. Another conditional sentence, this one with aeon plus the subjunctive. Right, kaukesomai, from kaukaomai, which means to boast. Right, I think that word is normally has a negative connotation, but Paul actually uses it as long as you're boasting en kyrio, you know, then he actually uses it positively. So we've got aeon plus the subjunctive, and then the future indicative passive is the very last word in the verse, aiskunthesimai. This is from aiskuno, which means to embarrass or disgrace someone or to put them to shame. And that's a future indicative passive, hence the translation as we'll get to it. Verse 8 then, for if I boast something more abundant. So te there is the direct object of the middle deponent verb kaukesomai. And parasateron probably just modifies te. It's almost like if I end up saying too much, that kind of sense, about, peri plus the genitive, about our authority, the authority of us. Now we have the relative pronoun, and we translate which the Lord gave. Now, you remember that pronouns, the case of the pronoun is determined by its function in its own clause. This one is the wrong case. It, quote unquote, it should be accusative because it would be the object of gave. But this is a very fun thing to say, and it means nothing theologically. But this is called the attraction of the relative. And if that makes you happy, then you're at least half as big a geek as I am. Sometimes a relative pronoun is attracted to, really, James, I'm not making this up, attracted to the case of its antecedent. And in this case, the antecedent is exousios, which is genitive. Does this make any difference? No. It could just be bad grammar, but Ruth, you have to have a name for it. That's right. That's right. So, yeah. Well, actually, if it's really bad grammar, you call it a solecism or anacoluthan. Yeah, oh yeah, that's right, yeah, right. Yeah, you have names for these things.
Makes it sound good.
Yeah, exactly. Phrases like random access memory and things like that. So let's do that again. For if I boast something more abundantly about our authority which the Lord gave for the building and not for the tearing down of you, that's easy enough. Even if this happens, if I go a little too far and talk about our authority, Paul says, now finally the then clause, I will not be put to shame. I will not be ashamed. And then, and now we get to this, verses 10 and 11 are this interesting phenomenon that apparently Paul has been accused of being sort of impressive when he writes, but he's a wimp when he's there. And that's actually the topic that's going to come up in verse 10. So, or 9 and 10, actually, and 11. So, but it's 20, we're supposed to stop 40 seconds ago. So we'll stop there. And we will pick up in Greek Club at 2 Corinthians 10, verse 9. Thank you very much.